So sometimes stuff happens in our life that we are not fully expecting. It's part of being a human. So last week I was outside with my son. We were playing football, throwing the ball around because, you know, you got to get out, get the fresh air while you can, get the body moving, the blood flowing. And my son threw me the football and put it a little high, so I jumped up to grab it, and it hit my finger in that right spot. And I thought I just jammed it, but it did hurt a bit more than a typical finger jam. And so I looked down at it, and my finger was pushed forward and off to the right, and I thought, I don't think it's supposed to look like that. But I'm not a huge fan of going to the ER, and so I thought it'll get better, and I waited 3, 4, 5 hours, and it continued to throb and hurt, and it turned purple, and I looked at it, and I thought, man, it's just not supposed to look like that. So I finally gave in, went to the emergency room, and not only was it broken, but the tendon was ripped off or something like that. Now, if you ask my son what happened, what he'll tell you is he put a little too much heat on the ball, which I guess we'll just go with that. But regardless of how it happened, I was not expecting it. There is an occurrence that happens in our faith. I believe it's an occurrence that happens to everyone. It comes out of nowhere, and it's very unexpected. One theologian that I like to read refers to these moments as uh-oh moments. I think we've all had them. In the year 2000, I was working part-time for an air cargo trucking company. I was a driver. And I was on one particular drive in the mountains of Colorado, very rural area. And I was following the map because at that time I didn't have GPS on my phone. I was still using a paper map. And I was looking down at the directions for a delivery that I needed to make. And it took me down this like side dirt road. There was a ditch on either side of the road. It was large enough for one vehicle to pass at a time. And about a quarter of the way down the road, maybe half a mile down the road, it just stopped. And the road ended and there were trees. And I looked around and I wasn't driving in a Mini Cooper here. I was in a 26-foot box truck. And I thought, uh-oh, now what do I do? We all have uh-oh moments in faith in which it seems like we've reached a dead end. When we get to those moments, there is a voice that gets really, really loud. We'll call it the voice of doubt. I'll never forget, I was standing in a slum in northern India years ago. I was surrounded by poverty. I was surrounded by people living in indescribably deplorable conditions. Sewage was running through the street. Children were partially clothed. People sleeping on dirty mattresses in homes the size of my bathroom. For me, it was an uh-oh moment. Where is God in the midst of all of this? It was the voice of doubt. Or maybe a tragedy has struck your life. Maybe you've experienced an unexpected loss. Maybe something happened that you do not understand, and you have an uh-oh moment of faith. Or maybe someone challenges what you believe and you cannot seemingly or logically refute it. A lot of college students have uh-oh moments. And uh-oh moments lead to uh-oh questions. Questions like, where was God? Or if God is so good, then why does he allow these types of things to happen? Or maybe you're wrestling with the truth that you've lived your whole life serving God, and yet your children chose a very different path. Or maybe the question for you is, if God is so loving, then what do we do with the concept of hell? Or maybe you're in a place where you don't feel God and you're just wondering, where is he? Is he even there? I want to turn today to a story in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9. The story begins in verse 14. Now, just before this story, Jesus had taken three of his disciples up on top of a mountain, and Jesus was transformed in their presence. He revealed his divinity to them. They had this incredible experience. They then come down off of the mountain and join the other disciples. We then pick that story up in verse 14 of Mark chapter 9. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them, and the teachers of the law were arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder, and they ran to greet him. "What are you arguing with them about?" he asked. A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son, who was possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him on the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and he becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not." Now, in Matthew's rendition of this very same story, Matthew refers to these episodes as epileptic episodes. And so Jesus looks at him and he says, "You unbelieving generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring me the boy." So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into convulsions. He rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like this?" "From childhood," he answered. "It has often thrown him into the fire or water with the intent to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible for the one who believes." Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." I love this story because it is the paradox of our humanity. I do believe, Lord, but also help me because I don't believe. I do believe, but help me in my unbelief. Now, how can belief and unbelief both exist in the same person at the same time? Well, first, it begins by a proper understanding of the word belief and unbelief. See, in this particular context, the way that the Father is using it, he's not talking about belief in God or Jesus. He's not talking about existence or ability. What he's referencing with this word is the idea of trust or not trusting. I would argue that every single one of us at some point in life begin to struggle with doubt. But I don't believe doubt has to become a dead end. Doubt can actually become a catalyst for deeper growth. People of great faith often suffer bouts of great doubt because they desire to grow. See, there's another voice that speaks. It is a voice that speaks to the gap between the frailty of our humanity and the all-sufficiency of God. That is the voice of faith. Now, faith means different things to different people. As I've understood the scriptures, as I've considered the word faith as it's used throughout the Bible, both the Old Testament and the New Testament, what I've come to discover is that faith is an openness, often an unconditional openness to God in the midst of our very real life. The good, the inspirational, but also the disappointing, the confusing, and the contradictory. The writer of the book of Hebrews, chapter 11 of that book, defines faith as confidence in what we hope for, assurance about what we do not see. Look, faith and certainty are not the same thing. Now, most of us are addicted to the idea of certainty. I know that I am. I need to know how things work out. I need logical explanations for everything. Yet when all of life is consumed in certainty, there is no room for mystery and certainly no room for faith. See, faith is not certainty. Faith is trust, even when we do not see. See, doubt is not a dead end, but an opportunity to practice trust. In 1997, I stood at the altar and I made a commitment to a woman. I made a commitment of trust. Now, as I stood at that altar wearing my tuxedo, my wife Rebecca wearing her wedding gown, I could not be certain as to how the future would unfold. Now, I was confident that this woman standing next to me loved me, and she was confident that I loved her. We had a deep sense of trust, but we didn't have certainty. I wasn't standing there thinking, boy, I sure hope this thing works out because there's not a plan B. I didn't have that, but I also didn't know how the story was going to end. I mean, I suppose there could have been moments of doubt. I suppose I could have stood there thinking, maybe she's just marrying me for my good looks and my money. Now, if that's true, the joke was on her because our first year of marriage, I made $6,000. But over the last 23 years, I have lots of evidence that my wife loves me. Now, we've had some rough patches, seasons of uncertainty like all relationships do, but our trust in one another has grown. Our faith in one another has grown. And while neither one of us can ever be certain about the future, because we are frail human beings, we have faithfully and unconditionally opened ourselves to one another. We trust one another. We have faith in one another. Listen, God is not looking for us to simply make a religious intellectual assent, but to open ourselves up to Him, to trust Him, even when there's rough patches. I think one of the greatest lies that we as followers of Jesus tell ourselves is that once we start following God, nothing bad will ever happen. It's why we're so shocked that when tragedy strikes, we're taken back and we ask the question, where was God in all this? It's because we cling to a promise He never made. He never promised us life would be perfect. Listen, the discomfort of uncertainty is the birthplace of faith. A 16th century friar named St. John of the Cross wrote of an experience that he called the dark night of the soul. He used that phrase to describe spiritual crisis, a sense in which God seemingly has abandoned us and we question everything that we believe. Do you realize that there are many characters in the Bible that wrestled with doubt? Many characters that wrestled with a dark night of the soul. Abraham and Sarah, the forefront of our faith, the father of our faith, wrestled with doubt when God told him that he was going to have a child. Though he was old, he was way into his 90s. Matter of fact, Abraham and his wife Sarah laughed at God when it was mentioned they were going to have a child. Job, in the Old Testament, doubted God in the midst of severe suffering. In the Old Testament, Gideon doubted God could use him to turn the tide against Israel's oppressors. And Thomas, one of Jesus' followers, doubted him even after he appeared to them rising from the dead. If we look through history, Martin Luther, who's responsible for the Protestant Reformation, was once approached by an elderly woman who was troubled by her doubts. And he said to her, "Tell me, when you recite the creeds, do you believe them?" And she said, "Yes, most certainly I do." And he replied, "Then go in peace, because you believe more and better than I do." Billy Graham, one of the heroes of modern day faith, when he was in his 90s, was asked if he believes that after he dies, he will hear God say to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant." He paused, and after a long and surprising look of inner struggle, he said, "I hope so." So what do we do with our doubts? What do we do when we doubt God, when we doubt faith, when we doubt life, when we doubt ourselves? I would suggest we begin by offering mercy to ourselves and to others. There's a really small book at the very end of the New Testament. It's only one chapter long. It's called the Book of Jude. And in verse 22, he says simply and pointedly, "Be merciful to those who doubt." And yet the Christian church has an ugly history in the way that we treat those who lack faith, for those who have doubts about what they believe. Now someone's going to say, "Well, that's fine, Mike, but what about the book of James chapter 1 verses 6 through 8? What do we do with that? Because it says don't doubt." Let me read it for you. James chapter 1 verses 6 through 8. "But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt. Because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded and unstable in all that they do." Now I read this and I feel terrible. I feel guilty. I feel shame. Like, is there a psychological mind game going on here? What do I do? This says don't doubt, but sometimes I doubt. Well, part of the problem is we take this verse so out of its context. See, when you open the scriptures, we've got to realize it's part of a bigger story and a bigger narrative. We can't just pluck verses out of the Bible and use them in isolation. Because if you go one verse back, James chapter 1 verse 5, we read the context in which James is speaking. He says, "If any of you lack wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt." In this particular passage, he's specifically addressing the idea of wisdom. So you've got to understand the scriptures. You can't just pick it apart, take what you want, leave things that you don't want out. Like, the Bible is not Golden Corral. It's not an all-you-can-eat buffet where you can just take this and leave that. You've got to understand it as a whole. And as you understand it as a whole, give yourself and others some mercy. Because doubt isn't like a spigot that you can just turn off. It's why I love the story of Mark chapter 9 so much. Let's go back. Because what we discover in this story is doubt is often a season and attached to a life event. So Jesus comes down the mountain. This man is with his son, and he pleads with Jesus. "Jesus, if you can do anything, take pity on us." See, this father is in a delicate season. He's at his end. Loving parents cannot stand to see their children suffer. And here is a man who has watched his child suffer and suffer and suffer. And so he comes to Jesus and he uses a very raw and honest word. He uses the word if. Jesus, if you can do anything. If is not a really faith-filled word. If is the word of desperation. And yet so many of us have if-filled moments. In 1996, I was sitting in my car. I can remember it, a 1995 Geo Prism. I was sitting in my car in the parking lot of the college that I was attending. I'll never forget that day. I could take you today to the exact parking place that I was in. It was evening. And as I was about to get out of my car, I had this overwhelming sense of heaviness and doubt. Now, keep in mind, I was studying for the ministry. My degree track was pastoral ministry and theology. But in that moment, I was a year away from graduating to being ordained into the ministry. And in the moment, sitting in the Geo Prism, I felt this overwhelming sense of dread and doubt and anxiety and pressure and questioning everything, myself, my calling, God. It was an overwhelming moment. Maybe you've had a moment like that. In those moments, we hear the voice of the loving Father who simply wanted his son to get well. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. John Ortberg, in his book, Faith and Doubt, tells the story of a woman named Agnes. He writes, I think of Agnes from the time she was a young girl. Agnes believed. And not only did she believe, she was on fire. She wanted to do great things for God. She wanted to love Jesus as he'd never been loved before. She knew Jesus was with her, and she had an undeniable sense of him and his calling on her life. She wrote in her journal these words, "My soul at present is in perfect peace and joy." She experienced a union with God that was so deep and so unconditional that to her it was living rapture. Then she left home. She became a missionary and gave God everything. And then God left her. At least that's how it felt to her. She wrote in her journal, "Where is my faith? Even deep down, there is nothing but emptiness and darkness. My God, how painful is this unknowing pain? I have no faith." She tried to pray. She writes, "I uttered words of community prayers and tried my utmost to get out every word, the sweetness that my prayers had to give. But my prayer of union is no longer there. I no longer pray." On the outside, however, she worked, she served, she smiled, but she spoke of her smile as a mask, a cloak that covers everything. She wrote, "The inner darkness and dryness and pain over the absence of God continued on year after year after year with only one brief reprise." This happened for nearly 50 years. Such was the secret pain of Agnes, who you and I know as Mother Teresa. He continues writing, "To be uncertain, yet still care for others is maturity. To be uncertain and yet cheerful is to develop and grow as a person. Sometimes we have to make 100% commitment to something even though we do not have 100% certainty in our beliefs about it. We can live in the midst of uncertainty with joy and courageous commitment. And when we do that, we will change. We will become, maybe not certain, but more faithful. And faithfulness matters more than our certainty. It just doesn't feel as good. Listen, I don't believe doubt has to be a dead end. In our doubts, we can be like the loving father who cared for his son and offer what little that we have. This man looked Jesus in his eye and he said, "Lord, I believe." He was offering his last shred of faith to Jesus. He said, "Lord, this is all I have. And I believe and I give it to you because I desire transcendence. I desire something that I cannot see." Jesus once spoke in the Gospel of Matthew of having faith as small as a seed. If your faith is as small as a seed, he says, you can tell this mountain to move and it will be moved. Now, I don't believe that Jesus was talking about size here. I don't believe Jesus was saying you start with a faith that's the size of a seed and then you maybe move up to faith that's the size of a truck and then maybe eventually your faith will be the size of an ocean liner. I don't think that's what he's talking about. What I think he's talking about is offer God what you have and he's going to meet you there because there's so much more to see. See, when you hear the voice of doubt, remind yourself that you were created for transcendence. We desire transcendence, seeing things that can't be seen with the eye. C.S. Lewis once wrote, "Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exist." Why is it that we are hardwired, designed for purpose? Why is it that we long for purpose? Why do we think about life after death? Why do we need as human beings to worship? Because listen, every one of us worships something. Some of us worship God. Others of us worship celebrities and sports stars. But we all worship something. Could it be that in our intricate design, we were programmed for something more? I read an article about researchers at the University of Oxford who decided to test this idea. Were we actually designed, made for something bigger? Were we designed to believe in something more? And so they conducted a series of mass experiments all across the world, across cultures and continents, to see if there was anything in human being that was inherently dualistic, meaning belief in the unseen, belief in something more. And what they found is that beginning as children believe that their mothers and God are all-knowing. But as children get older, they realize their mothers aren't all-knowing, but God still is. This is true for children raised in non-religious households and in less religious cultures. And this predisposition and with childhood, adults across cultures overwhelmingly believe that there is something after death. This is true in Eastern cultures and Western cultures. This is true in developing nations and developed nations. This is true in religious societies and secular societies. Most people across cultures have a predisposition toward believing in an all-knowing God and life after death. Science itself proves this. They went on to scan the brains of people in prayer and discovered prayer transforms our brain. So when the voice of doubt is shouting, reach for transcendence, realizing you were created for more. When the voice of doubt is shouting, remind yourself that it is simply an opportunity for growth and not despair. Because if we go back to the request of the Father, "Lord, I believe, help me in my unbelief," that is a desire. When you hear the voice of doubt, may your prayer be the prayer of the father who cared so deeply for his son. Lord, I believe, but help me in my unbelief. So as you look over the course of your life, where have you noticed the small graces? Where have we noticed the fingerprints of God? Just today, I was sitting at my kitchen table, and I looked out the window, and I noticed a cardinal in one of the trees behind my house. Now, typically, I only see these brown, ugly birds back there, and they're always fighting with each other, but today there was this cardinal, and it struck me because of how bright red it was and how I don't often see that type of bird in my backyard. And as I stood and looked at that creature, the bright red of the feathers, I leaned back for a moment, and I was overwhelmed with faith. So wherever you find yourself today, even if you find yourself holding up a small seed of faith, let's offer that to God. Because listen, we become what we hear. We become what we are based on the voices that we listen to. So when we hear the voice of doubt begin to overwhelm us, may we lean into the voice of faith. May we hear a voice that calls us to trust our Creator, even if it means offering up a small seed to Him. Gracious God, we offer to you our faith. Sometimes our faith seems strong and impenetrable. And other times our faith seems so weak, barely the size of a seed. Would you meet us, O God, in all of our doubts, not causing us to feel anxious about it or guilty, but seeing it as an opportunity to grow, to mature. We offer these things to you now, in Christ's great name. Amen. So now as we wrap up our time together, do hope you will connect with us this week. If you scroll to the bottom of our website, northbrookchurch.org, there's a connection card there. I'd love it if you'd fill that out and let us know that you were here. And again, there's a place for prayer requests. We would love to pray over any needs that you might have this week. We're also going to continue now in our worship through our giving. I do want to thank you so much for your generosity to our church. You can give three ways. You can give at northbrookchurch.org/giving and follow the prompts. You can give via text by texting NBC and in the amount to 73256. Or you can write a check, place it in an envelope, and mail it to us here at Northbrook. We are checking our mail regularly. So let's now continue in our worship as we give offerings to God. So now may the Lord bless you and keep you. May you lean into the voice of faith. May the Lord be gracious to you. Amen. Amen. Have a great week.